Have you ever applied a skincare product to your body and wondered what kind of crazy chemicals are in it, and then read the ingredient list and realized you can't even pronounce half the ingredients? Your skin is the largest organ of your body, and what you put on it becomes part of you. In fact, if your skincare has chemicals you wouldn't eat, you probably ought not rub it all over your body. This is why in our house we use Tallow Skin Solutions Body Butter. It is made with all natural ingredients that are safe enough to eat and offer your skin the nutrients it can thrive on. The tallow is sourced from a family farm in Georgia, which practices sustainable regenerative agriculture. The body butter also has organic coconut oil, organic cocoa butter, and organic essential oils. The texture is silky and luxurious as it is whipped to the perfect consistency. Enjoy one of the five different scents. My personal favorite is creamsicle, which blends vanilla and orange and smells delicious. If you've never used a natural product like this, you are in for a treat. Go to tallowskinsolutions.com and enter code MINDFUL for 20% off. That's tallowskinsolutions.com and use code MINDFUL for 20% off your next order.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the Mindful Movement Podcast. I'm your host, Les Raymond. Thanks for tuning in today for another episode. I had the pleasure of speaking with Troy Grant from Beyond Rhetoric today. This is Troy's second time on the podcast, and it was great to reconnect with him. If you haven't listened to the first episode that we did, it was a couple years ago. It was a terrific conversation about the service that Troy and his organization provides. Very inspiring stuff. I encourage you to check that out, and I hope you enjoy today's round two. Troy Grant, thanks for coming back for round two on the Mindful Movement Podcast.
Of course, man. Thanks for inviting me.
So it's funny. We met initially at a farmer's market, and I haven't been going to that farmer's market. And then I happened to go there yesterday, saw you again, and we got to catch up a little bit. And as soon as we started talking, I was like, this is really important. Let's turn on the mic for this and do a round two. And this is like the quickest turnaround I've done from scheduling a podcast to creating one day.
Wow. I know exactly. And when I said to you, when you said, when can we schedule? I was thinking about my hectic schedule. And I was thinking, well, tomorrow is really the only time that I have free. And I was like, let's do tomorrow. And you looked at me like, really? Tomorrow? And so I'm glad we're able to have it because of your initiative. So thank you.
Well, I'm glad we can make it work. Thank you for making the time.
Oh, indeed.
So for the listeners, you've been on before when we were pretty young podcast a couple years back. Mm-hmm. And it was a really enjoyable conversation for me. And I want to get people caught up that haven't listened to that without spending, you know, as much time on the how you got to what you're doing. But you are the founder of Beyond Rhetoric, mm-hmm. Which is a nonprofit organization that works with kids at the Maryland Department of Juvenile Services.
Yes.
And you basically help bring together volunteers with, I guess, at-risk youth to mentor and lead and create opportunities and develop community. And it's inspiring. It's important. It's real.
Thanks.
It's like very real.
Yes.
It's local. And I'm grateful that people like you are out there doing this.
Yeah.
And I am honored to be a conduit for your message. Tell us a little bit more about what Beyond Rhetoric is and what brought you to that.
Yeah. So this will be kind of like a recap of our first discussion. I won't be as long-winded though, right? So Beyond Rhetoric is a nonprofit. So, you know, for those that know the letters and numbering, it's a 501c3, but it's also a public charity, right? According to the IRS, which is a 509a2. So if people are looking for a nonprofit or a public charity, we are that, right? We're young, right? So many people haven't heard of us because we're young. We were established in 2020 during the pandemic. And our mission and our goal is to simply serve youth in detention. And what that means is we go in and we try to move beyond the rhetoric, beyond the talk, and we go in and we serve them by being next to them, by being close, by spending time, by letting them know they're important, by being in their presence. You know, what's interesting is we don't feel we have to preach to them or, you know, lecture or scold or try to give them our adult wisdom in order for them to really to do well in our time there. We just feel like we need to spend time. You know, Brian Stevenson was a person who inspired this work. I read a book in 2019 called Just Mercy, and it blew me away. And that was about a guy who was at Harvard Law School. He was disenchanted with the overall aims and goals of the school. And it's like, what am I going to really do with my life? Someone suggested he goes to Alabama to spend time helping get innocent people off of death row. And I read that book and it changed my life. And the movie came out that same year in the winter of 2019. And so essentially, in a nutshell, Brian Stevenson believes that we have to get proximate to people in need, right? We have to wrap our arms around them and affirm their humanity and dignity. And that proximity is what Beyond Rhetoric is all about. Stop talking, right? That's the rhetoric piece. And serve. Just spend time with youth. You know, anyone can argue politics. They can argue a lot of things. But what they can't argue is the fact that you're sitting in front of a youth. You're spending time. And the youth will not be able to deny that, right? Many times we go in, Les, at first the students or the youth, I call them students because I'm an educator, the youth want to know, like, are we paid? And we're not. This is an all-volunteer organization, even after 3 years. And so that gives them, and they love the fact that we're not paid because it means something to them, the fact that we're spending time with them. So that's essentially what it is. You know, we go in and we spend time. So when I meet people, what I say to them is, hey, you know, what are you good at or what do you like doing or what fires you up? And they say it. And then I go, can you do that with youth for 1 hour a week in detention? And that's really how it starts. And that's how the discussion gets started. And so that's Beyond Rhetoric in a nutshell.
That's great. It's something you just said, to affirm their humanity and dignity. Mm-hmm. That sounds really important for someone that's had a tough go at it and they're in those like developing years. I mean, these are generally, on the majority, I would say, young teenagers, young yes. to mid teenagers.
Absolutely. So they're, you know, I would say median around 15 or 16 from our experience, but from 18 down to 14, are kids we spend time with. I've spent time with kids that are in middle school, older middle schoolers, right? Probably have stayed back a couple times, but I've spent time with kids in middle school and, you know, just spending time with them. And you're right, affirming their humanity is important because, you know, our society tends to, especially with our criminal justice system, it tends to separate. It tends to alienate and exclude. And by doing that, you know, the message that one receives, and one being the youth, is that they're really not that important, right? That they're otherized, right? There's something else. And so by spending time with them, that contradicts that concept. Because as I'm looking them in the face, if I'm sitting down playing a game of chess with you and I'm saying, oh, wow, that was a good move. Just simply, that was a good move. Or the fact that I'm sitting down with you, right, giving you my time, lets you know, it sends the message that you're important. And it's not just chess. You know, when we have a basketball program. So when Marcellus Clement is playing basketball with the youth, and he's a principal, right, of a middle school. So, but he gives up his time to go and play basketball with the youth. He's letting them know they're important. And they want to know, why do you come here? They always want to know. And if it's just because you're important, right? then they get that, and they hopefully we can wrap our arms around them so that when they come back to the community, they feel like they're a part of something greater, and that their one mistake. Brian Stevenson says that we shouldn't be judged, right, by our one mistake, right? One decision shouldn't really be our final, shouldn't be the death knell. So, yeah.
Yeah, now we live in a society, I mean, especially if you see on like social media how the masses will try to identify someone with the worst moment of their life.
Oh, yeah. Oh, 100%. 100%.
And that has an effect on, you know, I just think of that age. I'm thinking about when I was that age and how every other day I was doing something that eventually would be considered like regrettable. Mm-hmm. And,
oh, yeah.
You know, and I had it good. Like I got punished, but it didn't land me in a place where I felt otherized that I remember. And I wonder, like at this age, I would assume that trauma plays a big role in some of the events, like the unluckiness that gets a kid in a juvenile detention center.
Mm-hmm.
How do I say this? What are the chances that a child that's at that age recognizes that how they might have been affected by their circumstances, and it's not just like their fault in a way? Like I assume a lot of kids feel like they kind of deserve to be there or something. Like, are there at that age, are kids connecting the dots of their circumstances growing up and the outcome that they find themselves in at that moment?
That's a great question. So I would say it's a very complex, right, question and answer, and to actually live through it. Like, so when we go in to the detention centers weekly, right, we spend time with a number of you, some who are on the spectrum of the higher, you know what, I did some pretty messed up things and I'll never do it again. Others who are not, you know, so there are different levels to the detention centers, right? We call them detention centers as a generic term, but there are different levels. There's really three levels in the state of Maryland that we interact with. There's what you call the typical detention center. That's for kids who haven't been adjudicated yet. They have not gone through the court system. They're waiting to be tried. But then there's a couple other branches. There's something called, and that's typically 30 to 90 days. Then there's something called community detention. So they're in there for 30. And in fact, Les, sadly, I've interacted with kids who've been in that pattern for well over a year. Mm-hmm. And so I go in every, you know, and I say, oh, my court case hasn't come up yet, right? But for over a year, I've played chess with the same individuals, right? Then there's another category called community detention. And what community detention is they may give the youth an ankle bracelet, and they put the ankle bracelet on the youth and they say, your crimes aren't so severe that you can't still engage with the community. So you can go to school and you can work, but every evening, it's called the evening reporting center, you need to report at a certain time. And then we spend time with you and then we drive you home on a bus and we drop you off, pick you up and we drop you off. And so that's the evening reporting center, right? And then finally, there's what they call the treatment centers, right? Treatment center is when you have been quote unquote convicted, right? You've been considered guilty. And with juvenile detention, which is different from, or with the juvenile system, which is different from the adult system, is juveniles are still considered, you know, that they can be rehabilitated. With adults, that's not the goal of the criminal justice system to rehabilitate, right? Just lock them up. So with juveniles, they have treatment centers to address the areas that the youth may be struggling with. So let's say they sold drugs. Then they would go to a treatment center that teaches and instructs about drugs. Let's say it was a sexual crime, then they would go to a treatment center for that. And those are for long, long stints. You know, that's more than 90 days plus, right? It depends on the conviction. So when we engage with youth, some youth have that, right? Like, wow, right? I'm a victim of my circumstances. But that takes a lot of complex thinking, right? A lot of the youth just blame other people, right? Which doesn't take a lot of complex thinking. In fact, that's kind of like the mature reaction, right? Right? It's not my fault, right? It's their fault. And then some, though, are on that lower spectrum. Some just don't know that they're caught in this web, this very complicated web that different actions, right, influence. You know, one of the things that happen whenever I play chess, I can always tell the type of, you know, direction or angle I need to go in with a youth based on how they respond to a loss. There are youth who, when they lose, they smile. And they go, yo, that was really cool. Because they're really connecting with the fact they're seeing the whole thing. And they appreciate how they lost, right? Or how they won. And every year, a youth beats me in chess that I go in. These kids are smart. And then there are the youth who their immediate reaction is, yo, you cheating. And it's typically the same type. You know, when I interact with these youth, it's like, I said, what do you mean? Man, you cheat, man. I won't play this no more. And it's like, dude, and now I'm accustomed to saying, you can't, just because you lost the game doesn't mean that the game was rigged. You have to learn the game. You have to get better at the game. And then I always have somebody, I said, he used to lose all the time. And I point to another youth in the, you know, in the quote unquote area in the cell. And I say, he used to lose all the time. Guess what? He's better now because he learned the game. Bro, if you don't learn the game, you will be a victim and you always think that you're a victim. And that parlays to life, right? So, but I don't know if the majority look at themselves, you know, complexly and say, you know what? I think the reason why I'm this way is because my parent or because, you know, my environment, had I right. not been around, you know what I mean? And so
the self-awareness that's required, I would just think it's such a long shot to have enough at that age group. So you see these parallels of the level of self-awareness they have or lack thereof that lets them play the victim in like the game of life just manifests in all these little aspects, such as like a chess game where right. it's not their fault. But I mean, most people, I mean, I'm 46, and I don't think I began to have self-awareness to see some of those things till I was in my 30s. So right. like, right. how's it expected? So is it only in the treatment side of those like three categories where a kid can be educated of those things if they're in that system?
Yeah, no. So the goal is to educate them. I watch. So we're not a part of the Department of Juvenile Services, right? But so what I do is I watch, right? Whenever I go in and I interact with all three of those systems. But when I watch each group and the adults, the residential advisors, spend time with them trying to infuse, right, these life lessons, trying to infuse the encouragement and for them not to be so down on themselves, which you're right. You know, at a young age, what do they say? The prefrontal cortex doesn't really develop until like age 25. So here we are expecting them to be able to make these decisions and even logically think through, you know, actions of the past and decisions of the past. And it's just a difficult thing. So yes, they try to, not only in the treatment centers, but also in the evening reporting centers and also in the detention centers. They, you know, what I'm really impressed by, sometimes I see the residential advisors, they have to have what they call group. And they'll say, let's circle up. And sometimes I go there to play chess and they'll go, oh, we're having group. Can you give us like 10 minutes? I'm just, sure. And I'll just go to another, you know, unit and I'll spend time with them and I'll come back. And what they do in that time is they talk accountability. They go, hey guys, yesterday, you know, we got all our, you know, activities cut out. And you know what? If you guys keep doing what you're doing, and then you'll have a youth step up and say, yeah, man, that was some nonsense. I don't mind that we play around, but some of you guys play too much. And so what I can see is that there are levels of, you know, accountability, levels of, you know, responsibility. But, you know, Les, I'll share a story with you. I don't know if I shared this with you before, but when I was 16, I could have gone to jail. And my life would be different. It's part of the reason why I do what I do is because I don't really see a huge distinction between me and these youth. I just see it's a matter of circumstances, right? And also sometimes I joke with people and I say, hey, you know, you picked the right parents. When they brag about who they are, or they brag about their accomplishments. Hey, you picked the right parents, right? Facetiously making the point that sometimes it's just a lottery, right? So when I was 16, I was on probation by the age of 12 because I used to steal and do all kind of crazy things. But I lived with my dad. I lived with my dad for 2 years in Providence, Rhode Island. So when I was 16, I was living with my mom. And living with my mom, I started working at Exxon. And I was a gas attendant. And I learned how to steal. I would, this is, you know, for all your listeners out there, beware, right? So what I would do is I was very strategic in my, you know, my thievery. So one of the things I would do is I would pretend that I was putting oil in your car. I would, you know, person would come up and they go, hey, do I need oil? And I would, you know, put in the stick and I would, you know, pull it halfway and I would erase some of the oil. Let's say it was full. I would take my, you know, my paper and push it down to where it looked like half. I said, and I would show them the stick. Yeah, you need a quart. And then they would pay me. Meanwhile, and then I would pretend to give them a quart of oil. Because prior to them coming, I would put a fake empty quart, right, on the stand so that they would see me grabbing. This is how conniving it was. They would see me grabbing the quart. And then I would throw it. This is age 16. So they can hear the empty quart of oil.
Oh, my.
And then I would show them the new stick. Here, it's full, right? And so remember, this is back in the late 1980s, right? So that was one thing. But how I almost got caught is I would also rig numbers. So if you look at a gas tank, what you'll see is a bunch of numbers. Those numbers correspond to gallons. So what I would do is I would learn to change those gallons. There was a guy who came in late every single Sunday morning. I would work late. He would come in Sunday morning. When he came in Sunday morning, he didn't have the time to read the tank. Before you come in and before you leave, you're supposed to read the tank. Write those numbers down. Those numbers correspond with money. Because of course, if you started with 100 gallons and you pumped 50, and let's say it was $1 a gallon, you know, way back in the day, then you should have $50 in your, right, in your cashier's box, right? Am I going too fast? And so I knew that those numbers corresponded with gallons and those gallons corresponded with money. This is at age 16, right? New Haven, Connecticut. So the guy would come in late. And when he did, he would always go, man, yo, bro, I'm so sorry. Can I just use your numbers? And after the first time, I thought, sure, you can use my numbers. Then I thought, wait a second. So what I started doing was changing the numbers. So it looked like I pumped less and he pumped more. Meanwhile, I would take the difference in cash. I was doing this less for several weeks. I pocketed close to $1,000. As a 16-year-old, that's a lot of money. And I'll never forget one night. This is where the parenting comes in. Remember, I lived with my dad for 2 years. But my dad used to say to me when I was getting in trouble in Providence, Rhode Island on probation, he used to say, like Bonnie and Clyde, you can keep doing it, but you will get caught. And I just ignored him at age 12. And he would say to me, Troy, like Bonnie and Clyde, you can keep doing it, but you will get caught. So at age 16, I'm getting ready to do my thing. It's a Saturday night. And that line popped in my head from I don't know where. And I started getting afraid. And I'm like, why am I afraid right now? I just ignored it, but it kept coming back, Les, like Bonnie and Clyde, you can keep doing it, but you will get caught. So it freaked me out so much that I said, okay, I'm not going to not steal, right? Because this gig is getting good. What I'm going to do is I'm going to create two pieces of paper, one with the actual numbers and one with the fake numbers. And if he comes in on time, then I'm going to use the actual numbers. Lo and behold, that guy came in on time the next morning. I gave him the paper with the real numbers. I folded up the other one, put it in my pocket, and we parted ways. The next morning, I came to pick up my check. I'll never forget the guy, my boss. His name is Kevin. He goes, "How's it going?" I said, "Things are going well." He says, "Good. How's school?" I told him, and he looked at me and he said, "If you don't tell me how you've been stealing, we're gonna have you leaving here in handcuffs today." I was mortified. And of course, I was a very good liar. So I said, "What are you talking about?" He goes, "We know you've been stealing. And last night we had the cameras on you. If you would have stolen last night, you'd have been out here in handcuffs." And I said, "I don't know what you're talking about. I'm a really good employee. I don't know why other people's shifts are," because he told me about other people's shifts. "I don't know why their shifts are coming up short, blah, 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 blah." And he gave me my check and he was like, "Get out of here. You're fired." And I walked away and I thought, had my dad not said those words to me, I would have went to jail as a 16-year-old. I would have been in detention. I would not have been able to go to the United States Air Force. The Air Force gave me the GI Bill. I wouldn't have been able to have the GI Bill to pay for college. I wouldn't have been able. There's so many ripple effects from that. But did I pick the right father? I don't know.
You're not going to believe this. This is going to make me want to sell stock in Exxon. But when I was 17, I worked at Exxon and I was stealing.
Is this a support group?
This podcast is going a different way. I had a system. I remember getting caught stealing when I was young once, like 13, 14, some stupid thing at the grocery store, and got caught. And it just makes me wonder, like, what a fine line between getting a slap on the wrist and maybe ending up in a facility where it's really hard to kind of claw your way back.
Right.
It makes me think of just kind of how privileged I am.
Right.
But I was stealing. I was working at a cashier, and some drug addict, granted I was a drug addict at the time too, but like a heavier drug addict that was like my mentor there was like teaching me how to steal by memorizing the certain costs of like routine goods and keep a tally.
Yeah.
And you'd pick up like an extra $20 or $40 a shift.
Right.
I was 17. It was crazy. And then I started stealing cartons of cigarettes.
Right.
And I didn't have a car. I would store them in my friend's car and we would sell them and share the profits. We would sell cartons of cigarettes for $8 in the high school parking lot.
Wow.
Not a pack of cigarettes.
Yeah.
So for the listeners, but this is back in, around 93 or something. I think they were typically like $20 and we sold them for $8. Yeah. So it was like an easy sale.
Right. Yeah.
But eventually also got caught one day. And I guess at this point, really grateful that I got caught.
Yeah. Oh, 100%.
Very grateful that I got caught and it cost me. And I acted like I didn't do anything wrong, but they took out the exact amount I took like that week or something.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, $100 even or something. They took it out on my last paycheck.
Right.
And, I deep down, like I couldn't get mad because I was like,
right, exactly.
This is what I needed. Right. I don't know if I thought of it that way, but there felt like a clean walk away. Like I wasn't mad that they took it out of my paycheck. It felt like I got some closure. But man, what are the chances that we both were working at Exxon and thieving?
Right. Exactly. I know we both got off, I should say.
Yeah.
Where other kids don't, they get caught up in the system and then they stay there. Right. And it's one thing after the other. So, I'm grateful. I'm really grateful. But at the time, did I, were I to go to detention, would I have been reflective? I don't know. Maybe I would have. Maybe I would have doubled down. Right. And so what's interesting is when I do, your listeners may not know this, but, since that time, I'm really perceived as a very accomplished person, right? So I got my bachelor's degree, graduated magna cum laude from City University of New York. I went to Johns Hopkins for a master's of arts in teaching. I got my PhD at UMBC in language, literacy, and culture. I've done things less like, I think I'm the only person, you can fact check this, who's ever recited the United States Constitution from memory. And I did it in public. Last time I did it, and the most celebrated time, was at the Constitution Center in Philadelphia. I gave everybody a copy of the Constitution. I said, check me. It took me over an hour to do. So I share all that to say that most people, when they look at my resume, They see that, oh, wow, this guy's pretty accomplished. But that could have all been different. You know, my brother died in prison, right? So his life took a different turn. I don't know why my life didn't take a different turn, but I'm very grateful. And that's part of the reason why I do what I do.
That's interesting. Can I double click the story about your brother a little bit?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely.
Is he older or younger?
He was a year and a half older than me.
And you grew up in the same household, same parents? Or
same household, same parents, slept in the same bed, took baths together. We were, you know, freaking frack.
What do you attribute the difference?
That's a great question. And I can tell you, when he died in 1995, as my only brother, I remember crying. You know, it's interesting. I just took a road trip with my son and I was telling him about the times that daddy cried. And he looked at me and he was like, "You cried?" And I was like, "Yes, dude, we cry. Men cry." So I remember crying in 1995, leaving the, you know, the penitentiary where he was. He died in prison. And I remember crying. At the time, I was a Christian. Unless I remember asking God why, right? I remember saying two things. One, why did you let me get so close to him towards the end of his life so that this would hurt so much, right? Because we were estranged for a couple of years because we went to prison. He blamed everybody except himself. And so we didn't talk a lot because he would say, it's your fault and you should send me this and you should send me that. I'm like, I'm not sending you Reebok pumps in prison, bro. I'm just not doing it. And so there was a fall. Yeah. And that was a big thing back then. But those were, you know, and that was a time. So we got closer when I found out that he had HIV and he was dying because a guy in prison wrote me. He says, "I know you and your brother are close. You need to resolve some stuff because your brother is dying." And I didn't know that. So then we got closer. But then, of course, when he died, it hurt. But then I asked God, why do I get to live and he dies? I don't know why Alan did the things he did. You know, when we look back on his life and I talk to the family members, they would say all the things that he did. And I'm thinking, he did that? You know, I know he sold drugs, right? I know that I remember when he got out of prison or jail one time when he was a teenager, he was walking down the street a couple of days after he got out and he had a gun. He was holding a shotgun going to sell it. And I'm thinking, you just got out of jail. Are you kidding me? And so I don't know what made him do the things that he did. I can say he's the one that introduced me to stealing. The first time I stole was him saying, "Hey, Troy, so you like bubble gum, right?" And I'm like, "Yeah." I was probably 8, okay, or 9. He goes, "There's these cars, right? And if you steal it, I'm going to be the lookout and you get the bubble gum and I'm going to take the cars because I can trade the cars with other people." And there I was doing, I got caught. And he did not say, "Hey, I put Troy up to it." So he had a lot of challenges, Les, that I don't know. Same mom, same dad, same household. And yet
were your parents split up when you were young at all?
Or? Yes.
How old were you guys when that happened?
So I was still an infant when they divorced. Okay. Yes. So he had to be probably a little over 1 or something, no more than 2 years old.
Because I wonder about that, like, you know, learning about stress a lot and trauma over the last several years, the individual variability in the response and the threshold and the tolerance to different stresses is so, like, it's such a vast spectrum of variability. Mm-hmm. And it makes me wonder, like, if you have two people, same environment, really, same influences. They could respond like, you know, I don't know if it could happen at that age, but I think about me, I was 4 or 5 when my parents separated. And I could imagine that if I had a sibling close in age, which I did have a couple sisters, that the feeling that one child would have given that situation and the way that it forms beliefs about them, because I think from my understanding, we form beliefs about ourselves at a pretty early age, all subconsciously. You know, we don't have the self-awareness, as you alluded to, we don't have the prefrontal cortex developed for it. But whereas one might feel like a lack of worthiness because the parent left and you feel like you're not worthy of their love, if you were, they'd stick around, and you form beliefs about yourself based on that, which lead to behaviors and patterns and activities that, right, you know, you treat yourself as an adult that way, deserve, you know, that you deserve that to be that. Whereas the sibling might just interpret the scenario differently, create a different set of neurotransmitter, like a different set of chemicals in the brain, different perspectives and different beliefs that could be very different. It could be like, I'm going to be a, you know, this is going to turn me into a superhero I'm going to be so nimble. I could, you know, be this for my mom, and over here I could be this for my dad, and I and like have a total different response, even though, and you know, and maybe there's even like nutritional components to that. I heard somebody talk about how when a woman gives birth, it's so depleting of energy and resources and nutrients that in the ideal scenario, like you breastfeed for a couple years while you're building up, you're repleting your nutritional status so that you're ready to have another child.
Wow.
And if somebody rushes that, or they don't have good nutritional status, then the next child is like behind the ball a little bit. So the way their brain might develop, not necessarily worse, but differently, because it's a different set of nutrient status from the mother, because let's say they didn't have 2 years of abundance food and nutrition to like regroup the resources. There's like all these weird variables that I think could affect why you could have two kids in the same household, same environment, with very different outcomes. I assume now that you're pretty happy that you were able to reconnect with him before he passed.
Oh, 100%. And I've kept all the letters, even the ones where he's cursing me out and calling me all kind of names. Yes, I mean, but going to what you're saying, and this goes to like individuality and personality, right? Like, so, you know, some people, I think what they, you know, some psychologists call it post-traumatic growth. Some people respond in a very positive way after something bad has happened to them, right? Whereas others, they collapse, right? And they implode. And so what's to say it's supposed to happen, it will happen to one person and not another? And that's the great mystery of life. And this is what should keep us all humble, right? Because I don't know. You know, one of the things that I remember my brother doing early on, maybe at age 7 or so, I was 7 or 8. I'll never forget one day we were walking down the street and my brother points. He points to the ground and he goes, he used to call me Choi, right? He didn't pronounce T-R-O-Y, he pronounced it C-H-O-I, right? Hey, Choi, Choi. And he was like, you see the money? You see the money? I found it, right? I found it, right? And what he was doing at age 8 or 9, right? Because he's a year and a half older than me. What he was doing was trying to prime me to corroborate later that he found money on the ground. But what had happened is he had stolen the money from my mother's purse and he threw it when I wasn't looking, only so I can, you know, see it from at a distance and go, oh yeah, you did. Wow. Look at that money over there. But later, Les, I thought, How can he steal from mommy? Like, I could never steal from mommy. Now, I don't think that way to think that I'm better. But what it does is it makes me wonder, well, why did I not have the capacity to steal from mommy? And why did he have that capacity? Right. And so that in my spiritual journey, it kind of freaks me out because I could have been born with that capacity. Right. But I wasn't. And I don't know why. So hopefully this should keep us humble and keep us serving.
I want to switch gears a little bit. I know we could talk forever about this childhood stuff and the work that you do. I know we talked a lot about the work you do in the first episode that I'll link to. I do like that post-traumatic growth
phrase. I'm gonna dwell on that in my mind for a little bit. So I ran into you yesterday, and there was something that you kind of surprised me that you shared. I don't know if we talked about it on the podcast or if it was outside the podcast, but you know, in the mindful movement, we talk a lot about breath over the years. And I don't know how it came up that you were having some like respiratory issues or something, but I love to hear. And I get personally inspired by anytime somebody like heals from anything, like self, or like improves their health and becomes their own advocate, does the work, creates change. And I learn a lot from others that talk about their journeys. You were eager to tell me that you've been breathing through your nose. I guess you weren't when we last met.
Right.
I could be quite the salesman on nose breathing.
Oh, yeah. Yo, so this funny is you're the only one that's ever accused me of being a nose breather. Like, it's the way you said it too. It was so hilarious. I told my friends afterward, I was like, this guy just looked at me and goes, "You're a nose breather, aren't you?" And I was like,
"You mean a
what?
Mouth breather?
Like, a mouth breather. I'm sorry. Yes, a mouth breather. Yeah. You're the first person that ever called me a mouth breather." And so when you called me a mouth breather, I was like, "What in the world?" And you recommended a book called Breathe.
Oh, right.
Yes. Yeah, and great. So I listened to an audiobook, and I decided to start changing my habit and to start breathing through my nose. And so, you know, prior to that, I was telling you that I had a lot of respiratory issues, lots of that prohibited me from exercising and prohibiting me from running and prohibiting me from doing a lot of things. And it'd been that way for over 20 years. Okay. And so back in earlier this year, back in January, I had a friend that said, "Hey, I'm going to run a 10 miler. And I'm thinking, okay, well, how are you going to do that? "Well, I'm going to do intervals," she said. And I thought, okay, well, can I do that too? And she said, sure. And so like 2 minutes running, 1 minute walking. And that's how you start to enable you to run a 10 mile marathon or 10 mile race. It was a cherry blossom, the DC cherry blossom. And I started doing it, and lo and behold, I only breathe through my nose. And I was able to run a 10 miler for the first time in my life, Les. Then the same friend said, "Hey, I'm doing a half marathon, right? In St. Michael's in May." I was like, "Can I do it too?" And I did that. And so now I'm a runner. So I run and I only breathe through my nose.
So do you feel that shifting from breathing through your mouth to breathing through your nose has had an effect on the performance side of, is that what's, do you attribute that to allowing you to exercise, whereas before you felt like you couldn't?
Yeah. So I think that breathing through my mouth, right, being a mouth breather, as I was called, I think what it did is it didn't regulate, right, my hormones in a way that needed to be regulated. And I'm sure you know exactly what I'm talking about and which hormones were stimulated or triggered. But what it did is it may have compelled me to think that I was in shock, or compelled me to think that I needed more oxygen than I did, which exasperated my lungs and caused me to have some type of respiratory challenges, right? Now, I still have respiratory challenges, but it's not to the level that shuts me down. Like I ran for 7 days straight last week, 3 miles a day. And I was still able to breathe. I was still fine, but I only breathe through my nose.
Gotcha. And so are you enjoying those drugs? I mean, those hormones that running cultivates?
I absolutely love it. You know, my youngest son said to me, because we were on vacation, right? Each day that I ran, and he said, "You're a different guy in the morning." Like, basically stay away from me because I was just pumped. I get, you know, the runner's high. I'm fired up. At night, I'm no good. And so absolutely, the runner's high is something I look forward to.
It's funny. I told you that you're looking svelte, and I am an idiot. I made the mistake. I bought a shirt from you. You had the stand at the farmer's market for Beyond Rhetoric, and I wanted to support. And I was like, "Oh, if we're going to do the podcast, let me buy a shirt and I'll wear it on the podcast." And I look at you and I'm like, "What size do you wear?" I'm trying to guess my size. And I'm like, in denial of how much weight I've put on, and to think that I was going to wear the same shirt that would fit you. I put it on this morning for this, and I'm like, that's not going to happen. I wish you gave me a look to say, you sure this is going to fit you? I should have sized up. So I'll give it to my son.
That's hilarious. No, look, babe.
Makes me want to get back and run. I haven't been running. I still exercise regularly, but I have a lot of years of running, and I just have very little interest. But then I see how how great you look. No. You really look physically like healthier, more vibrant than when I saw you last. And I assume the running has something to do with it.
Oh, 100%. And I appreciate those. And I always tell my friends who are talking about weight loss, and I talk to my sons about this all. I said, listen out for the unsolicited, right, encouragement. Because it's those that you can really trust and believe in. When people you haven't seen for a while. And I was at the gym the other day, and this guy I haven't seen in a while, he looks at me, he goes, man, oh my, you're slimming down. And I thought, yes, that is what, because, you know, if you go around telling people, hey, guys, I'm on a diet here, and and this is what I'm doing, then, of course, they're going to feel a little compelled to say, hey, okay, yeah, you look great. But when folks just say, you're looking svelte, and I appreciate the word, I love the word. It's the first time it's been used on me in quite a long time, so I appreciate it less.
Yeah, it's funny. I checked on the video from our first conversation, and I look like a different person. I'm probably 30-plus pounds lighter during that interview. And I feel pretty good, and I feel really strong in some ways. But like when I do pull-ups, like, man, I feel that weight.
Yeah,
it's a real difference. Like when you're picking up weight off the ground, the extra weight feels really good.
Yeah.
When you're picking your own weight up.
Exactly.
It feels a lot heavier.
Exactly.
So that's interesting. Thank you for sharing about the nose. I do think it's so powerful. When I work with people in the gym, the first thing, you know, the first day we're always talking about like lifestyle habits, just kind of get an idea of what their like sleep hygiene is and nutrition. Mm-hmm. But when we go to the teaching of movement, we always start with breathing, and we spend a good amount of time on it. And a lot of folks just don't understand. Like they came to the gym, they're ready to do the pushups or the whatever. And it's hard for me to convey to them like how important, I say, like, this is the most important thing you're going to learn from our experience together.
Mm-hmm.
And Absolutely. Second place is really far away. Like, it's just so important. This is the rhythm of your life. It's going to be an anchor, a portal to the present moment that you're going to be able to rely on forever. And yeah, it'll affect whether you're hypoxic, whether how you feel, your ability to perform, exercise and such. So thanks for sharing that success story.
It speaks to being mindful, because there are times when I'm out there and I feel like, oh my goodness, this hill is tough. And then I go, no. Regulate your breathing, right? You're not going to die, right? Just breathe. And then it helps. It helps me be in the moment. It helps me be present with the activity that I'm doing, which is the whole concept of mindfulness.
Yeah, man. Something else you mentioned yesterday that I wanted to hear more about. I know you're a teacher at a high school, but you also said you started teaching at HEC, which is the local community college.
Yes.
And you're teaching criminal justice there?
Yes.
You mentioned that you integrated the kids from the class in the Beyond Rhetoric. Can you elaborate that a little bit and talk about what that's meant for the kids?
Yeah. So that is one of the biggest, one of the biggest highlights of the year. So, we met at the farmer's market. So, we're out there pretty much every Saturday, from May and through until November. And one of the contacts I made last year was a professor 2 years ago. And so she took the card, she walked away, and then she emails me out of the blue and says, hey, can you come and speak to our students? They're criminal justice majors at Howard Community College. And sure. So I went and I spoke to them about what we do, what Beyond Rhetoric does. Then she says, would you like to teach a class, criminal justice? Sure. This is awesome. I haven't taught, post-secondary in a while. Just busy. And so I said, sure. And so I taught a criminal justice class. And then she said, can we do a partnership? And that partnership was an internship. And so we would find students who were interested in going into the juvenile detention centers. And so we found six, and they got 3 credits. And what they had to do was just go into the detention center. They had to read a couple books on juvenile justice and or the criminal justice system. And they had to go in every week in order to earn their credits. And it was phenomenal. So we had 6, and they went in and they learned and they grew, and they gave a presentation at the end of the semester. And without fail, all of them went in there a little afraid, right? Because they didn't know what they were getting into. And then they left feeling more connected, and with comments like, these kids are so smart. I couldn't keep up with these kids, right? In terms of chess, right? They're so nice, right? Oh, I love such and such, right? And so that was awesome. So I had them follow us. And so they could either follow us, what we're doing, or they can create their own. And there's some young ladies that created their own volleyball program. We didn't do volleyball. We didn't offer volleyball as Beyond Rhetoric. And so they created volleyball with the all girls facility. And so for a semester, every Sunday morning at 11, they went down there and played volleyball, and I joined them. So with the youth, and then the other young ladies, they were all six, the 6 of them were women, college students. They went to our chess programs, right? You know, at different times. During
all all the volunteers in the all of class them. Were yes. female?
We will get a male this
What
semester.
Happened to the guy?
I know, right? The guy's punked out, man.
So, did you give him shit for that? Or?
I did. You know, okay. You know it. I'm like, what's the deals, man? Come on now. I thought you were going to sign up. He's like, yeah, man, you know, blah, blah, blah. So, but we do have our first male coming on this semester, which I'm really excited about.
I got a question. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
You know, you mentioned earlier, Troy, that it meant something to the youth at the facility when they realized that you weren't getting paid, that the volunteers were truly volunteering. So when the students from the community college class came in, that essentially were getting paid 3 credits, you know, not money,
yeah.
But, you know, they were incentivized. Did that show up in any way to the youth, to the kids you're working with? Like, did they pick up on that and respond differently, knowing these people that are closer to their age? So you think that I would think that there'd be like some connection because they're more of a peer group, but did it not feel as meaningful to them? Right. Did you get that sense that they were like, oh, these people are here because they have to, or they're getting a carrot dangled in front of them?
Right. Great question. So one of the things that so I didn't sense that at all. And I'll tell you how meaningful it is that they know we don't get paid. But what I asked the interns to do is to go in and state why they're there, and state it in a way that's youth focused. Like, we're a criminal justice, I'm in college, but I want to be closer to you all to see how things really are in here. Mm. So what that does, contextualize in that way, right? It lets the youth know that they're still, you know, they have agency and they're really the authority. And the youth that are serving, or the, you know, the college students, they're not going in there like, hey, I know everything, right? Or you're a study subject. They're going in there with the humility of, listen, I really want to know how things are. And we had this, internship conversation. Is it's like, you are going in there to see how things really are. You can read a lot of books. It's great. But I want you to go and interact with these youth, right? A la, you know, Bryan Stevenson's, you know, being proximate to those who are suffering. And so we didn't sense that at all. I mean, there were some challenges with their age. A couple of the youth were, you know, they hit on them a little bit. How old are you? Right? You only 19? You know, that kind of deal. Uh-oh, what you doing when I get out of here? That kind of deal. And so, you know, we had to squash that really quickly. But they did a good job just blending in. but to the point of how important it is, I'll never forget one of the biggest compliments I ever received from a youth who said to me, oh yeah, I'm sitting here playing chess with him. And he looks at me and he goes, you get paid for this? And I go, no, I don't get paid. And he goes, you don't get paid for anything. I said, no, man, this is my church, bro. I come here 8:30 in the morning, bro, to spend time with you guys. You know, and I told him, I said, my brother ended up dead in one of these. And so I'm here. And he looked at me and he goes, that's why I fucks with you. And then he moved his piece. And that was the end of that. And that was one of the biggest compliments, Les, I've ever received from a youth in detention. So he, quote unquote, messes with me because he gives me time because I'm there for him. There's no bigger compliment that I receive in detention.
That's a great story. And I want to question you on it. I don't want this to come off as like a challenge. It's funny, at one point in this interview, you mentioned I was past tense Christian. Mm-hmm. And then I just heard you say, this is my church. I mean, obviously, right. You know, we all have we all are selfish to right. some, you know, we have to be. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, one, like, what's the selfish part of you? Like, mm-hmm. you know, it's yeah. hard to do something good for something else. And there's not a part of it that it's like you're making your feel, you're doing it to feel good also. Like, it feels good to give. Like, right. you give right. any kind of gift. You give a dog a bone, it feels rewarding right. to you, even though, mm-hmm. yeah. you know, the dog's not saying thank you or whatever. They're taking right. Any kind of kind gesture. It's not all just for the other person. You know, there's yeah. a lot of value that we get out of it. So I wanted to, I guess, two part. What do you see yourself when you practice the self-awareness of what you're getting out of this? I'd like to hear more about why you consider this your church. Mm-hmm. And also, like, has this process, if you want to touch on why at one point you felt Christian, as mm-hmm. if it was past tense, has that changed? Yeah. And if so, why?
Yeah, that's good. These are multiple point questions, and I love them all. And this is great that we're doing this on a Sunday morning too. because it feels extra spiritual. Gotcha. Okay, so there's a couple quotes that really, really helped me in terms of my journey, and especially with this. You know, there's a guy named E.M. Forster, right? He's the guy that wrote, I think, A Room with a View. He goes, how do I know I am until I see what I do? And then that piggybacks off of what Aristotle said some 2,300 years before him. And he says, virtues are formed in man by his doing the action, hence beyond rhetoric, right? I'll never forget, you know, reading the book of James when I was a Christian. And yes, it's past tense. To the chagrin of some people out there, some of your listeners, they're like, oh, he's a heathen. So I know, right? So in the book of James, it says true religion is taking care of widows and orphans. And James was apparently Jesus's brother. And that always stuck with me. And James also says, you show me your faith by what you say. I'll show you my faith by what I do. And I was like, James is my man. Okay. True religion is taking care of widows and orphans, right? Basically, this is real here to James. Like, go out there and take care of people who need you. That's what real religion is, right? That's how I feel like I'm going to be judged. You know, in the Quran, it states that all actions will be judged by their intentions. And so what I want is to live a life that's based on the doing piece. You know, you ask about the selfish part. Yes. I don't think that, you know, I think I have long since given up on the, you know, the concept that altruism actually exists. Right, that there's such a thing, a pure altruism. But I don't know, maybe somebody can find it. But there's this book that I highly recommend. It's called The Wonder Drug. And we profiled it on our, we do a newsletter every month. And so it was one of the books that we profiled. And basically it's a scientific way of showing how compassion and altruism is the best thing for us, right? Once again, I highly recommend it. It's written by two MDs. One guy, I believe, is an MD, JD, MD, and he also has his Juris Doctorate, so he's a lawyer. And their goal is to show that this is good for us. Like, compassion isn't just something we don on for other folks. This is actually good for us. It increases our health. It increases the longevity of our lives. It increases, you know, it lessens our, you know, our blood pressure. It so many reasons, right, why we should be. One of the things that struck me in the book, Les, is he said that a lot of people have this concept that you're on this continuum of being other interested or self-interested. And he said there's this guy, I think his name is Adam Grant, no relation, this psychologist who said, no, that's the wrong way of looking at it. You've got to look at it as there's the other interest continuum, meaning you can have a low self-interest, right? Or a low other interest, or a high other interest. So a high other interest is you're really invested in other people. A low other interest is you're not, right? You can have a low self-interest or a high self-interest, right? High self-interest people, self-interested people are egomaniacs. Low self-interest are probably, you know, probably discouraged and depressed. But what he said is that you have to, the most successful people are people that have both high self-interest and high other interest, because they know how to not be a doormat, right? Because if you have high other interest and low self-interest, then you're a doormat. You're just doing what other people want. Mm. And so I think I have high self-interest or higher than average self-interest and then higher than average other interest.
Gotcha.
And so that's what puts me on that. And some people are pathological altruists, right? Another term from that book, that, you know, despite, you know, all indicators, they're so unhealthily focused on other people that it's to their own detriment and their own needs. I'm not that guy. I serve. And after I serve, I come home to my sons and we hang out. We go to movies. We chill, right? I go on dates occasionally, occasionally. I work full time, right? So it's not, everything is not about service. I'm credentialed, as I shared with you earlier, right? So no, everything isn't about serving, but not everything is also about myself. And so I want to strike a good balance. That's why what we do at Beyond Rhetoric is I said, hey, what are you good at? Can you do that for an hour a week with youth in detention, right? This book, you know, that I highly recommend, I'm not getting paid to push their book, but it said that scientific research shows that 100 hours a year is the optimal number of hours for you to start getting, right, the rewards for altruism or the reward for compassion. Okay, 100 hours a year. We ask for just an hour a week, which is half of that, right? So 100 hours a year is like truly 1% of your time. That's it. So if you gave 2 hours a week, that would be your 100 hours given to anything beyond yourself. So what I hope that we do as middle-class folks, specifically, those are typically the audience that I'm speaking to, middle-class folks, is just serve. You're blessed, man. Or you're favored, or, you know, let's say it another way, you're fortunate. And so since you're fortunate, since you've been taken care of, relatively speaking, I know we're not all perfect, but relatively speaking, since you're taken care of, then you can do something for other people. 1 hour, 2 hours a week, let's get it done. And then finally, you know, I remember that I'm growing in this. Les, I'm not naturally compassionate or naturally altruistic. I'm not. You know, Gandhi said compassion is a muscle that gets stronger with use. And so I'm just trying to get more compassionate. And that's why I do. I'm in the doing phase to help me become more.
That's great, man. It's inspiring. You got my head spinning. I used to work with these at the gym. I used to work with these kids every year. The local high school would reach out to me, and I would work with a couple, I guess, like special needs kids, and it was very rewarding. Mm-hmm. And you know, you grow a little attached, and then they'd be gone.
Yeah.
And and with the pandemic, they shut that down, and it hasn't really picked up again. And it's like I'm hearing you and getting inspired, and I'm looking at my life and my time availability, which is kind of high right now. My kids not needing me much, and I'm like,
yeah.
I feel like you're holding
you're helping me hold a mirror up to myself from an angle that is needed. To you know, get up and contribute more than I am.
Well, it's what I went through when I read the book, you know, Just Mercy. You know, as I shared with you in our last meeting, you know, I was just binge watching television, you know, I was just like, you know, dating a lot. And it's like, you know what? I appreciate good shows, and I appreciate the great company, you know, of a beautiful woman, but this is not me. Like, there's something that's missing, right? And so what was missing was that purpose piece, was that there's something out there that I can actually contribute to. And so it makes me feel right better. And I think that by doing all those things, going out there, dating, and I was trying to lift myself up in some way, right? And Booker T. Washington says, you know, if you want to lift yourself up, lift up someone else, right? Like, clearly just lift up someone else. And that helps us. You know, we're in a country, we don't have the highest suicide rate in this country, but my goodness, right? A lot of people are depressed and, you know, drug overdoses, and, you know, it's challenging. Well, one of the reasons why we're so self-focused, it's like, take some of that time, just some, and give it to others. And so I feel like a superhero, Les, when I walk away from the detention center. And not only that, when I spend time with the other folks that are serving, people in my tribe, I'll call them, I feel like a superhero. And then I go to work and I hang out with my kids. And then it's just, that's the balance that I hope to have. This is, once again, this is all volunteer, this organization, this 501c3. So
can I, yeah, I want to hear more about, and I want to be a conduit for you so that you could reach more people that could maybe help out, whether financially or with their time. But I want to go back to the topic we're just talking about for a little bit more insight from the kids' view. I'm very interested and curious about how the youth in these facilities respond to really the way society is presented to them while they're in, you know, this confined space. It's like this environment that's just in my, when I think about it, it like doesn't feel right in my blood.
Right. Right.
Like kids are in this situation. And when you told the kid you were working with, when you were playing chess and he asked you if you're getting paid, and like, maybe he didn't believe you the first time, and you're like, mm-hmm. really? And then when he gets it and you say that, no, this is my church.
Right.
How do you interpret what he thinks about hearing that when he hears, like, are they learning? Do you think that in that moment, the kid across the chess table from you mm-hmm. is learning something about life for them by hearing that you're doing this as a need for yourself? Like, when you say it's your church, when you tell him it's your church, you're telling him, like, I need to do this for me into some way. Like, I need this. Mm-hmm. I'm not just here for you. This is my medicine. Do you think he picks up on that and learns from that?
So that's a good question. Well, so I don't know if I would characterize it the same way you do in terms of, like, this is for me and my medicine, although that may be implied. Because when I used to go to church, I never looked at it as this is for me. I actually thought about it as a community. I thought about it as a part, and I was just an epitome, right? I am a part of this larger community that I go to every week and that I spend time with. And these are the people that I know. And I never looked at it as something I was getting out of it personally. Never, I don't think. And so when I think of church, or when I think of a gathering, when I think of my students who go to the mosque, right? Or I had a couple Jewish principals, right? And they would go to the temple. When I think of that, I think of something you're participating in, but not hierarchically and not selfishly. Now, so do we get stuff out of it? We do. But it never dawned on me the entire time that I was a churchgoer for 10 years that, and that was in my adult years. I, you know, as a child, I went with my parents. But in my adult years for 10 years, that I was getting something out of it for me. So I don't know if that communicates to the youth. Like, so the way that I say it was, no, this is how I come together. This is how I break bread, right? Gotcha. This is how I take communion. And so what's funny is, so
you're telling him essentially like, no, you're my people. Like,
there you go.
You're my people.
There you go.
Gotcha.
And that's why he say, this is why I mess with you. And he dapped me up and then he moved his chess piece. What's funny is that I went just to provoke a conversation with the girls. I had left there that day and I'd gone to the all girls facility. And when I went to the all girls facility to play chess as well, I asked him, I said, hey, the guy was asking me about why, you know, whether I got paid. I was like, why did he ask that? And I knew the answer, but just to provoke a discussion. And one of the young ladies says, he want to know if you real or not. I was like, what's that mean? She's like, you getting paid, like you gotta be here. And I thought, it makes sense. They want to know that people care about them less. That's what they want to know. And that's what we all want to know, right? That's what we all want to know in relationships, right? That people actually care about us. You know, I just left one job and one school and I'm at another school, right? I was at that school for 8 years, right? After a while, I didn't feel valued. So I put in a transfer card for the first time in 8 years. And so why? I didn't feel like they cared. And that's really what it boils down to in relationship. And kids are no different. They just want to know that we care.
Right. Yeah. We're all just big kids.
Yeah. Come on, man. You know it.
Well, congrats on your new chapter that you're about to start. School year is about to start, I guess, this week.
Teachers go back tomorrow and then the young ones come back a week later.
Are you in the same county or
no? I live in Howard County, Maryland. You're, you know, for those that are not here, there are like 23 counties in the state of Maryland. I live in Howard, but I teach in Prince George's, which is, I used to do a 45 minute to an hour commute one way. Now at only 23 minutes. So, nice. Yeah, so that's nice. So that's a boon. Pay cut. It took a pay cut. But yeah, I know, right? Quality of life, man. Quality of life. Closer to home. Home when my son gets home from high school.
And that's so, worth a lot.
Oh, my. He won't like that. No, <it's> like, when I'm sitting on a sofa, legs crossed, right? So how was your day? You know, he's like, dag on it, right?
That's funny.
So yeah.
Anything else new on the horizon for you that you want to chat about before I let you go? I know we're pushing the time limit here.
So with Beyond Rhetoric, we've got a lot of good stuff. I mean, so now we have a solid 5 programs. We have, which means 5 different volunteers who go in consistently. We have a basketball program, right? We have a chess program. We have a fatherhood program. We have 2 new programs. One's called Cash Flow. I don't know if you remember, there's a book called Rich Dad, Poor Dad.
Yeah.
You got a guy named Robert, I think, Kiyosaki or something like that.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, he created a board game. So there's this guy in Baltimore who approached us and said, hey, I want to teach the kids about entrepreneurialism and how to invest and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, okay. I said, well, we don't roll like teaching the kids. It has to be a backdoor kind of teaching. So you have to do something because the kids don't want to just sit and listen to you lecture.
Right.
They just don't. So he said, well, there's this board game. And so he goes in every week, right? Sunday morning at 9 o'clock. And he plays this game called Cash Flow with the kids. And the goal of Cash Flow is getting out of the rat race, teaching kids investment and entrepreneurialism skills. I contacted the Cash Flow company and I said, hey, can you guys donate your board game to us? Because we're working with kids. And they said, absolutely. They sent their board game to us and that's what they play with. Now, here's the catch. Before we did this, what I encouraged Department of Juvenile Services, I said, we want to be able to reward these kids, right? And so we're going to give them a $100 custodial stock account. And so they have to do between 6 and 9 weeks of this game. And then we give them a custodial stock account that they cannot cash out of until they're 21 years old.
So that's awesome.
And so we are we finally have our first graduate. He's a kid that I'll call J-Dub. And he's been at this game for a while and he gets it. Now he understands the concept of investing, right? And so I'm working with the Department of Juvenile Services to set up that stock account for him as we speak. So that's very exciting. We did a stock market game with the detention centers that are the furthest west in Maryland. And then one of the young ladies from that internship program asked to stay on. She just says, I just want to keep going, right? I love these girls. And so she's 19 years old, our youngest intern or our youngest volunteer. And she goes every Sunday, she drives about an hour to do friendship bracelets with the young ladies. I didn't even know what that was. She had to send me a YouTube video. And she goes, the girls will love it. So as she's doing the friendship bracelets, the girls, the walls drop. And then they start talking because, you know, we're not allowed to ask them about their charges and any specific information because they're still minors. So, but if they tell us things, that will be fine. And so they'll drop, they'll say, yeah, I got to go to court on Thursday. I don't think my lawyer is going to be there. They just start talking. We could ask them questions. Well, what do you mean your lawyer's not going to be there? And then the relationships start. So from this, those two volunteers, one guy's name is Jamoke Jinyami. He does a cash flow game. And then Melissa DeLeo, she's the one that does the bracelets. They both are forming relationships. And out of those relationships, we're now with the Department of Juvenile Services trying to get them to mentor some of the youth that they've engaged with. So now that's the next phase of Beyond Rhetoric, the mentorship. And we talked about that last time, but now it's coming, is being crystallized. Because the last time we talked, Les, we were virtual because of the pandemic. Now we are in person, in the flesh. And so we've bumped into some challenges, right? Trying to get everything started and get everything consistent. But we've been going strong. And so that's the exciting part. The other new stuff is we had an auction last year. And we had a Shakespeare fundraiser. You know, one of the things that I share with you is we like to tap into people's talents and go, hey, what are you good at? Can you serve the youth? Well, there was a guy named Jeffrey Owens. I don't know if you used to watch The Cosby Show when you were younger. His name is Elvin on The Cosby Show. His real name is Jeffrey Owens. Well, he came down to the state of Maryland to give 90 minutes of Shakespeare at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum of African American History and Culture. And he said, all proceeds goes to Beyond Rhetoric. That was him using his talent as an actor to serve the youth. He didn't go into the detention centers, but he gave his time and we collected the donations so that we can further our cause. I get really excited. So please cut me off if I'm going too long.
No, man, do your thing.
We were so encouraged to be able to partner with the Baltimore School of the Arts. We had a young kid named Zion Ginyami. He, the son of that guy who serves with the cash flow game, he is an actor and in the Baltimore School for the Arts, and a guy named Ian Taylor, also an actor for Baltimore School of the Arts. Well, we contacted the Baltimore School of the Arts so that these kids can get service learning hours, which is a really big thing in the state of Maryland, service learning hours as high schoolers, but they can also learn from Jeffrey. And some of the comments were like, this is a masterclass. Working with him, rehearsing with him was like a masterclass in Shakespeare. It was amazing. That event was great. And then the auction, we had a great auction. We asked a couple actors to perform a scene from the documentary Central Park 5. For your listeners who are not aware, Central Park 5 was a case about five kids, both, you know, the all Black and Hispanic, who were accused wrongfully of rape. In like 1989. And they were sent to prison and sent to jail, and they were all innocent. And years later, DNA proved them innocent. Also, the guy who raped the woman came forward and said, and he was already in jail, and he said, yeah, I did that. And so they were exonerated. So they're known as the Exonerated Five. There's actually six of them, but they call them the Exonerated Five. There was a scene from there that was actual from the, you know, and I can send it, you know, to you if you need to see it. Then an actual interrogation of a youth that was so, oh my goodness. It was heart-wrenching how compromised this youth was and how basically they got him to admit to something that he did not do. So during the auction, I had a couple actors, Eliana Lutz and Spencer Grant, my son, act that scene out where the assistant district attorney is interrogating the youth, and the youth is having to lie about his guilt, even though he was innocent. So there's so much that we're doing on that. We would love to do more. I want to do a 5K fundraiser, but we're an all volunteer, you know, organization. We need somebody to step up and say, I can organize that for you. Right. And so that, you know, there's a lot of good things that we're doing. And so, yeah, please, anyone, please contact us. We need your donations. We need volunteers. And we need strong minds to help us move this mission forward.
And what is the best way? Beyondrhetoric.org?
Yes, absolutely. They can get in touch with us. You know, I had an epiphany about a year or so ago. Our vice president of Beyond Rhetoric, he sits on the board as vice president. His name is Collies Hall. He does so much. He does the fatherhood program, but he's also trying to help get their sound engineering program going with the Baltimore City Juvenile Justice Center. So that the kids can actually make music while they're there, but takes a lot of technical skills. And so Khalees is helping with that. But we had a meeting a year or so ago with a guy who was basically telling us all that we needed to do is Beyond Rhetoric. And you should do this. You should be doing that. You should be doing this. And Khalees stopped him and he said, hey, what are you willing to do for Beyond Rhetoric? And the guy was quiet. And since that time, Les, I've really establish a different stance. And that stance is, we are an all volunteer organization still. What we do comes from the heart. We don't have the quantitative data to get all the grants that we need. We just don't. We have a lot of qualitative data. We have a lot of anecdotes. But what we do is we interface with the kids. One day we will have that quantitative data that will make grant writers say, oh yeah, so this percentage of the kids that interact with Beyond Rhetoric are now completing high school. We don't have that now, but we have the humility as an organization to know where we are, and we never overstate, right, our abilities, and we say where we are. So beyondrhetoric.org, we need your help. We need your mind. If you have an idea, please don't email us and tell us what we should do. What I would like you to do is say, you know what? Here's a great idea, and I can do that for you. There's a guy named Robert Holder, doctor. I think he's an algorithmic engineer. I don't even know what that is, right? This guy's so smart. But he came up to us and he said, listen, I can't do the basketball. I don't have the personality to engage with the youth like you do. But I have other skills. So he decided to help us write grants. So that's how he is giving to Beyond Rhetoric. So please, if you want to contact us, yes, there's a lot that we can be doing and growing in. Our records are straight, and that's what we are really good at, making sure that every dollar is counted and accounted for. But we're still all volunteers. So we need your help. We need your volunteer hours, and we need your donations.
Well, thank you, Troy. Thank you for taking the time to talk with me today. And for the listeners out there, always grateful for your listening. And I encourage you to, at the very least, check out the website and learn more. And if you feel compelled to help out, then, let that part of your inside manifest and spread that love.
100%.
Thank you, Troy.
Yes, thank you, Les.
And I hope... hopefully we will do this again.
Yes, man. Absolutely.
Have a great day, everybody.
You too.
Thanks again for listening, everybody. I hope you enjoyed the conversation. I sure did. If you live local to Maryland, then I'm sure Troy would love to hear from you if you want to connect. And if you don't live local and you want to contribute or help out in any way you can, then please check out the website and give what feels right to you. My mom always taught me that if you can give, you should give. And if you can't, you should not. So be responsible and make sure you're taking care of yourself.
but it is a fantastic cause. And it sounds like they have the right people involved to really make the world a better place with your contribution. So I encourage you to follow your heart with that one. Thanks again for listening, and I hope you enjoyed.